Welcome to the Think Exchange podcast. I am delighted to have with us today Rob Zahri.
Thanks, Mark. Really good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. You know, I got started at about 8 years old when a friend of the family played the piano. My mother had a piano, but nobody really played it in the house. And one day, a friend came over with her son, and he played the piano that day. And I just remember hearing something in front of me playing a Beethoven piece, and it hit me so hard. I can remember the details of everything that night, of what it felt like when I heard the music. It kind of went through me, and it was that moment that I just knew something changed. And I was about, eight, 9 years old. And I guess, you know, it's one of those moments, I guess, you know, now being older that you wait for, and sometimes you wait a lifetime for them. I was fortunate enough for it to come early at that age. And, you know, it changed everything for me. I was stuck, you know, in my place. I couldn't move, you know, for that time when he was playing down. And I just, from that day on, it was my life was music. And I started to take a classical piano training with the same teacher that he was taking lessons from, a woman in West Orange, New Jersey, named Miss Chapinelli, an elderly lady. But very, very strict, you know, she was the type of, you know, teacher that would, you know, take your hand and aggressively move and fix your hand and, you know, have, you know, pencils and whatnot, you know, to try to on your
right
hand to give you timing and, you know, very aggressive, but, you know, you learn. It was like one of those teachers that you hated, but you love. So I took classical with her, and after a couple of years, she entered me into these competitions for classical music. So, you know, I found myself competing in this whole classical, genre against, you know, all of the different people from New Jersey statewide. You know, the winners would come together, you know, cross country, and we would, you know, the winner of that, the whole competition would get the top three spots would get a recital at that point. That was part of the winning of the top three places. And each year that I did it, I took either third, second, or first place. So I kind of gravitated to that very quickly. You know, I did that for about 6-7 years. You know, coming out of that, I didn't really know if I was going to find a career in classical music or piano, but I, you know, I do remember, you know, sitting in my room as a teenager and just listening to the records of the time, which were like Journey, Escape, and Rod Stewart, and Boston. I found myself, I found myself studying the records. I was enjoying the records, but it felt like I needed to know every little note, every nook and cranny of what was going on in these records that I was hearing and how they were getting that sound and what was the piano player doing, and I was trying to mimic it. And this is what I chose to do, you know, in my spare time. I wouldn't really go out with friends. I'd rather sit in the room and study the records. So there was always something there, you know, kind of calling me to do music. After a few years, as a teenager, I wasn't really writing any music yet, but playing in a couple bands, you know, a couple cover bands, and you're just kind of messing around with it, you know, nothing too crazy. I played for the choir at my high school, but I still really wasn't finding anything, you know, concrete with it. So I figured, you know, I wasn't really sure coming into the senior year if I was going to do music. So I applied to the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Well, maybe, you know, it's something that it seems to be the one thing that has stayed with me and I still love. So, I applied to Berklee, and I actually got a full scholarship to Berklee to attend. But I actually wound up not going. My father had passed away at that time, and I just said, you know what, maybe music is just, it's just crazy. What am I? I must be crazy thinking I'm going to do music for a living. But I didn't go to Berklee. I went to school at William Patterson University, and I stayed local in New Jersey, and I just studied business. I was trying to kind of run from the music and just and use my realistic, you know, side of my brain.
A lot of people do that.
Of course, it's a safe, you know, because it's scary, you know. You don't.
Yeah.
You just don't know. I wonder, was I good enough? Or, you know, what would it take? I just couldn't really figure it out, and nothing was really gelling. So, you know, went to college and, came out and I did a few jobs doing different things, but I certainly noticed that, you know, during this time, I was just bug. It was like a disease. I couldn't escape it. You know, so I would come home every night after work and go right to the piano. And then I started to kind of dabble in the writing and trying to figure out, you know, did I have any writing chops? So I found some people and, you know, did some co-writes, you know, local musicians. But, you know, again, nothing really concrete. And then I think what changed was I grew up in Livingston, New Jersey, and my mother was close friends for years with a singer by the name of Connie Francis. Yeah, she had a bunch of hits in the 60s in the pop genre. And so Connie was always, you know, around the house, and, you know, I was always talking, and Connie would take me to her rehearsals, and I would watch the conductors and the arrangers do their thing. It was very, very intriguing for me, obviously.
Of course.
And one night we attended one of Connie's shows at the Garden State Arts Center. And backstage, I had met a songwriter by the name of Irwin Levine for the first time. Irwin, I guess, had knew Connie. He had written some songs for her. And Irwin and I started talking. Strangely enough, Irwin was actually, he lived in Livingston as well. He lived about 5 minutes from where I grew up. So long story short, Irwin, I got to talk with Irwin, and I used to, you know, carry a demo tape around with me. So I had done a few, you know, very rough demos of songs I had written and produced. And, you know, in talking to Irwin, I passed him along this demo tape. And Irwin, this was a Saturday. Irwin took the tape, and I always would put my phone number on the cassette at that time, on, you know, the label, what sure it was. And Irwin had actually called me the next day, and he said, you know, I listened to the music, and there's really something there. I mean, you want to come over and, you know, maybe try to write with me. And of course, that was unbelievable to me. I'm like, absolutely. So I was over there in a matter of minutes. And from that point on, Irwin and I started writing songs. And this was really my first lesson in songwriting, if you will, with somebody who had done it. He had hits, you know, Tyler written on the little tree. He had a bunch of hits as a songwriter. So, you know, it really started the real education started at that point. Irwin and I had written songs for a couple of years. We didn't have anything published or placed, but it certainly turned out to be an incredible education for me. Unbelievable. You know, in terms of just crafting a lyric, keeping it simple, Irwin had a lot of really great, great ways of going about songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the songs that he wrote, the way that he would take a melody and the way that he would take the music and combine it with the lyrics in a way that's really simple for people to get it.
Exactly. They're very, right, they're very conversational. That's the one thing I learned from Irwin, is to keep it conversational. You know,
right.
So people can relate to it, you know. Because, you know, unless you're, you know, a very poetic writer, sometimes it's a Dylan or somebody will take these, and that's what they do. But, you know, for a songwriter who wants to get songs placed and you know, out to the world and published, or even sings for that matter, there's something about that simplicity that just always works. And to this day, I still, you know, I have to remind myself of that, because I can get carried away at times, lyrically as well as melodically. So Irwin and I had written for a while. And, you know, we kind of just parted ways, you know, as friends. It was all good. But we, you know, we had a little studio that we had built in his house. I had asked him if I could take the studio, the equipment. I was still living home at the time, so I brought the equipment to my mother's, and I put it in a very small room in her basement. I started going at it on my own and writing, and just, you know, because I was definitely feeling something different. I was you know, growing as a songwriter, changing. I was listening to a lot of Babyface at the time, a lot of 702,
right.
A lot of the Puffy stuff, the Bad Boy stuff was out. And I was really into it. I just liked this R&B thing that was going on. It was melodic but yet grimy.
Right.
I just dug it, and it felt like that I felt like I could do that. And I really
right.
took a year after Irwin. I studied it. I was into the records. I was listening to Jodeci. I was studying the harmonies. I was studying, you know, the productions. I was checking out the cats who were producing these records, writing these records. So I started doing some of that R&B in my own way. And
right.
sure enough, you know, a year and a half goes by. I still can't get anything going. I'm going to meetings in Manhattan, left and right, and meeting with record labels, meeting with, you know, marketing people, just playing music for anybody who would hear it. And I just couldn't get arrested. It was horrendous, and I'm down to $35 in the bank. And I'll never forget what I thought was about to say. Doing my car got towed. didn't know when I'm done. I'm going to get a job tomorrow. Of course, the tomorrow came and I woke up. I'm like, well, let me come see myself a couple of months. You know, so I stretched it out. And, you know, it's something changed. One day, a person by the name of Herbert had stopped by my house. He was friends with another guy, and I was friends with him. They came over by chance. I happened to be home. The other guy, my friend, was picking something up. He had a loan in his parents' guitar or something like that. And then Herbert said, I have to do this. And, you know, while I was looking for the stuff to give him, and he's like, so, you know, they started talking to me. He said, what do you do? Are you a producer? I saw him. Like, yeah, you know, I'm like kind of moving into this R&B thing. He's like, really? He's like, did you play something? Well, the record that I played Vince that day was a song called No, No, No that I was working on.
Wow. Yeah, and it begins, right?
And that's it. That's exactly the starting point. That's the, you know, the gun goes off, you know, with the ray, so to speak. And I played him No, No, No. I didn't have it complete, but I had like the verse and the hook done. And I had a demo singer. It was actually a male singing it. And right. I just remember, I didn't even get through the whole hook. He stopped. He's like, I need that. I mean, he's like, I need a copy of that. So I was still burning cassettes at the time. I had a Denon cassette player, so I burned him a cassette. And, you know, I thought that, okay, I'm going to give this guy the cassette. I'm going to hear him again. All the other people love him. Nothing ever seems to happen. So this is probably just another one of those things. So I gave him a cassette of No, No, No. And he actually called me that night. And he said, there's a new group called Destiny's Child, which obviously I hadn't heard of. And he told me about this woman, Teresa Barbara White, who is A&R, the project, on Columbia Records. And he's like, I played them the song, half of the song, and they want to cut it for their record. And I still was like, what are you talking about? This has got to be a joke, or you're playing with me, you know? So he said, what I need you to do is I need you to track the music, you know? So in other words, I need to put bass down and record the synths and the drums. And I had never even done that before. So he said he's going to send over all the equipment to my mother's house. So, of course, a couple hours later, a big truck back into my mother's house and starts unloading all this equipment for me to track the music, you know, No, No. And I'm just like, I don't even, you know, I got to lay a synth code, which is the thing to line up. I'm like, I've never done any of this. So here I am with manuals up till, you know, I was up 24 hours trying to figure this out. Finally got the music tracked. The next night, he invited me to Junkin Studios, and that's where I met Destiny Child for the first time. And he, you know, he was like, I want you to produce the vocals, he said to me. I'm like, I don't even know what that means. We need to produce the vocals. What does that mean? So, you know, I didn't say that, but it was kind of like fake it till you make it. So nobody in the room knew that I had no idea really what I was doing. I had never been in a recording studio before. You know, right. So here's the girls, and they're thinking that I've done this, you know, a million times, but I hadn't. And sure enough, the first person in the booth is Beyonce. And she started singing back my song, No, No, No. And I just remember thinking to myself, oh, my God.
You must have lost it.
I almost let it go off my chair, dude. I didn't show that emotion because I kept it cool. Like, oh, okay, great. Right. I'm sick. But inside, I was like, what the heck? What is this? This is like you only see this in the movies. This doesn't happen in life. This doesn't happen. And she just brought this thing alive. Like, I've never heard anything in my life. Even to this day, I don't think this is my first one. I mean, I had those moments, don't get me wrong, where Whitney is, you know, singing back my song, and it was that same feeling, you know, like Whitney Houston, but this was the first one for me, and Beyonce was just so incredible, the way she twisted and turned the melody, and she brought it alive. And, you know, I remember walking out of that session, finishing that record, just walking on, I could have walked, like, on buildings. I feel like I could have walked building to building. I was on a cloud. It was such a high that I was just like, the one thing I was thinking was, how do I keep doing this? This can't be it. I just remember saying, right, I cannot. This is too, it's like addicted. That feeling, right? You know, just having your record sound the way it's supposed to sound. Nothing happened to the record at this point yet, but. So, you know, shortly after that, I had received a call from Vince Herbert a couple of days later. He said, you know, I'm going out to LA to work on some more projects. He's like, I want you to come. He's like, I want you to do all the projects with me. And now here I am, you know, from one minute I can't get arrested to a couple of weeks later, I'm working on Master P, Bone Thugs and Harmony, Montel Jordan, you know, I mean, on the list goes on and on. It's insane. And it's like, you know, it's nuts. Like, I could not believe what was going on. He moved me out to L.A. Vincent Herbert moved me out to L.A. He got me an apartment. And literally, every day he would pick me up, like, around 11, 12 o'clock, and he would just drop me off at random studios in L.A., and I would make a record for that artist, and we would record that night. And this went on day after day after day. So it was like, it's the all or nothing kind of, you know, all or nothing kind of thing. So anyway, that went on for a few years. This wasn't really paying me. He was giving me my publishing credit, and he was giving me credit as a producer. But he wasn't paying me any money. So after a year and a half, I was like, you know, then I'm not going to have the conversation with you. Then I know what's going on, so I'm not going to say, hey, now you need to start paying me. I said to him, I'm going to go home. I'm going to go back. I'm going to go back to Jersey. Right. And I said, I'm going to try this on my own. I mean, I appreciate all the opportunity you've given me. I've learned I've learned so much from working with all these different artists and working with him. But I needed to, you know, I needed to take the next step. So I went back, and I remember coming back on the plane, and I got kind of teared, I got choked up. I was scared. I was like, what if this is it now? Because I haven't done it on my own. You know, so I was scared that maybe I wouldn't be able to get, you know, gigs, I wouldn't be able to get placements.
Yeah, and there's no safety net.
No safety net, nothing. And I remember I used to have this, like, you know, this Walkman type thing, and sure enough, the song that came on that I had, you know, in one of my mixtapes was Don't Give Up by Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush. And I just remember, like,
Right,
it just hit me so hard, and it was like, it was a sign. So anyway, I came back, and I just started, you know, calling people. I'm like, hey, you know, people I met, you know, over the course of a few years I've worked with Vince. And I said, hey, you know, just want to let you know I'm on my own. But, you know, if anything comes up, I'm here. I could definitely, you know, would love to work on projects with you. And the one person that responded immediately was Will Smith manager, this guy, Omar Lambert. And he's like, well, you know, we've been using these guys' track mixes for years on all the Will stuff, but he's like, we're ready to branch out. So he's like, we're working on this movie, Wild West. He's like, if you want to put together a couple ideas, you know, do you still send them over to me? And sure enough, you know, I put together two ideas. One was with that I Wish sample, Stevie Wonder. Another one was with Earthwind of Fire, Fantasy. And he called me back. He's like, you know, I played the track for Will. He's like, Will watched that I Wish record. And he's like, he wants you to come out. Write the lyric with him, you know, stay at his house, you know, and just, you know, figure out, you know, write a song and talk about it and just do it. So, again, I'm like, what is going on? So they fly me out to, you know, to L.A. And I just remember I get out to L.A., they put me in a hotel near Will Smith's house. And the day I get there, Omar calls me. He's like, Will's going to pick you up in a couple hours. I'm like, Will who? What do you mean Will's going to pick me up? why is Will gonna pick me up? I don't get this.
He's like, you know, he's gonna do it himself.
He's right there. He's around the corner. He lives down. Like, all right. So sure enough, a couple hours later, this red Bentley comes driving around the lot in the hotel, and it's Will Smith picking me up in his Bentley to take me back to his house. He had a little studio in his house, and we hit it off like wildfire. It was like, you know, it was amazing. We wrote a bunch of things. We finished Wild Wild West. And that's when, you know, after we wrote Wild Wild West, we started talking about who would be good to sing this. The Stevie part, the hook, and we just went back and forth with a bunch of people. I think one of us said Cisco, and it was just like, yes, that's good. So we just went after like this dream team, you know, for the Wild Wild West record. And we made the record, and I remember after we finished the record, because, you know, you hear a record so many times, you start questioning everything about it. Like, so I remember Will said, when we finished it, Will Smith said, there's one test I have to do before I can really put my stamp on this record. I'm like, what's that? He's like, well, Jada has to come in and give me the thumbs up or thumbs down. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, are you crazy? I'm like, we just spent all this time on the record, and we mixed it, and now she could completely just debosh this thing in one finger down. I'm like, oh my! So that had to be one of the most nerve-wracking days of my life. Because sure enough, you know, the next day Jada came in and it's me, Jada, and Bill, and he starts the record. I'm like, oh god! Like the sweat is pouring. It's pouring out of me. Like the sweat, I'm like sweating everywhere. And sure enough, like, you know, well, I shouldn't say sure enough, but luckily, in the middle of the record, she gets up off her chair and starts dancing like wildly. I'm like, We're good. I think we're good. I think that's a good sign. I think we're
going to get the stamp of approval.
Exactly. So, you know, she loved the record, obviously. So, you know, that record came out, did what it did. And, you know, during that time, I was trying to get back in with Destiny's Child on that second album. And we kept missing each other. Like, we scheduled some dates, and I couldn't get to the sessions, and they couldn't get there. And I was really looking forward to, because I hadn't really written with Beyonce on that first record. You know, that was just the record that was written for her, for the group.
Right.
So I was finding out more as time went on that she was a good writer, as we, you know, we've all come to learn. And I was excited about trying to get in, and we tried to figure, but I missed the record. So I was really disappointed. But somehow, when the third record came around, I was one of the, you know, the people that they called. And I'm like, absolutely. I mean, that's a dream for me to get back in with Beyonce and the girls. Obviously, things had changed by then, but, you know, it was still Beyonce and Kelly, which I love so much.
Right.
And we hit a moment working on that next Child record where it was like, you just have these creative moments. You have these moments that you can't explain, I think, you know, creatively, you know, in a career, right, in a path. And, you know, if you ask me how those records came to be, I can't even tell you because it was just such a, you know, I know some of the details, but I can't tell you how, you know, what made me do certain things and what, you know, how things came to be, because it was just like an energy, you know. And Beyonce and I had that, you know, it was just so easy to do things. It was like, oh, you change this, oh, no, I'll change that, you change that. It was just so fluid, you know, that you just, some of those things happen, and, you know, it's very much like that with Gaga. So you can't explain them, but it happened with Destiny's Child again. So we made that record. Obviously, Blue Delicious did well. I had four songs on the record. I did the Christmas album with them, and, you know, things were good. You know, it was like, it was just on a roll.
Right.
And then everything changed. Everything changed. I can still mark the day because obviously 9/11 was such a tragic day in everyone's life, but that's the day everything once again changed for me. And for some reason, I didn't want to keep doing what I was doing anymore. I was kind of at a crossroads, and I said to myself, you know, after 9/11, because, you know, the industry kind of shut down, budgets changed. I mean, I was, you know, getting incredible budgets. I did Whitney Houston, you know, before that, and everything was just really, you know, strong.
Right.
In the industry that changed everything. And I remember after, I think it was one of the last projects I did before everything changed, and it was 9/11. And I remember trying to take some time off after that. I think maybe for a good year, I wasn't really doing anything. And I just remember saying to myself, you know what, I need to be part of something. I want to start something from the ground up. You know, I want to find an artist and like mold it and like the sound and the look and the name and the, I want to do the whole thing. I didn't want to just, you know, be this, you know, cat who comes in and, oh, give us, we need a single, we need a song. I just, you know, that's cool, but that had run its course for me. You know,
right.
I was a little burnt out from it. So I remember going on this, like, you know, log cruise chase looking for this artist. Like, I know I wanted a female because, you know, I've had success with a lot of female records. And for some reason, my production and my songwriting, it sounds and it feels a little female to me. I don't know why that is. Because, you know, I was raised by my mother. You can go into that, the whole other story. But,
right.
You know, I'm very in touch with my feminine side. So my records come out sounding female. So I said, you know what? Let me get a female. Let me find a female. But let me find, like, a grungy female. Okay? And let me go back to some of my rock roots because I'm a huge Zeppelin fan, huge Rush fan. I'm like, you know. So I wanted to go back now and tap into the things I hadn't been doing. You know, R&B was not that, obviously. It's a whole different genre, a whole different world for me. But I want to get back to the Beatles and Boston, and Journey, that stuff that we talked about earlier.
Right.
I was on this hunt to find that artist, and I called her, you know, my Strokes girl. But I had found an artist in New York, a girl by the name of Rita, who was it. I mean, she was just it. I mean, she was perfect. And I did a bunch of records with her. Long story short, she actually wound up committing suicide. And, you know, that's
funny to hear that.
Yeah, she's young. She was 19.
Okay.
And it really threw me off the rails, as you can imagine. But, you know, I guess God works in mysterious ways because, not too long after, I had been working, started working with this artist. A friend of mine introduced me to this girl, Stephanie Germanotta. And I just remember, you know, I was always looking, but I remember, like, I wasn't looking aggressively at this point. So when this person called me, I was like, all right, I'll meet her. I'll talk to her. So I just remember, you know, vividly the day that, you know, she had come to the studio in Jersey and saw the place in Parsippany. And, you know, it's quiet. She walked in, and I just remember thinking to myself, nope, she is not it. I just something about the whole thing. Maybe I was not in the right place, but she it didn't feel like what I was looking for.
But, you know, she looking, was it just the look or the sound or what? I'm just curious about.
Well, I had heard some of the music. She had a pure volume thing. I heard a little bit of the music, but you know, I'm all about energy, and I always say a superstar actually changes the energy in the room the minute they enter. Like all the energy shifts to them without, they don't have to say a word, but it shifts.
Right.
And I'm not saying she didn't have that, but I'm saying it just, there was something about, you know, she was bubbly. I didn't want bubbly. I wanted dark. I wanted kind of like rolled out of bed, you know, kind of like hair messed up, like rock and roll shit.
Right.
She didn't strike me as that at first. So,
right.
but I said, no, she came out from New York. She took the bus. It's her birthday. So she came out on her birthday. No,
you can't just send her back, you know.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I couldn't
right.
do it. But you know,
yeah.
if someone was waiting for her outside, I would have probably sent her back. So, you know, I can't do this today. But since she did come out and she made the effort, I'm like, let's talk a little bit. So we talked for a good hour. And I'm like, what are you doing? I'm, you know, I'm trying to give her some points or whatever, like, you know, some advice. And I'm like, well, tell you what, before you go, why don't you come back on the channel? Why don't you get excited? Same time, but not expecting really anything so unbelievable, but I was wrong. And when she sat at the piano and started playing, I just, it was like that same moment where I talked about Beyonce.
No.
It was that moment again. I froze. I absolutely froze. I couldn't even move. It was that, it overtook me that, it was that big. And I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, I feel like I'm watching David Bowie, like for the first time, like a new David Bowie. Like, I'm like, this is what it must have felt like for whoever sat in the room with Bowie the first time. That's what
right.
I was thinking to myself, because that's what it felt like to me. She was jagged and she was rock and roll, and the piano was moving and she was chirping the piano and it was percussive because her hip was banging into the side of the piano. I'm like, shit started falling down. I'm like, this is amazing.
That is awesome.
That is
amazing.
Awesome. I just remember like her finishing. I'm like, you want to play another song? So she played two songs that day. Always a song called Hollywood. I love the lyrical way, the way she, it wasn't conventional. The way she said things, it was almost, it was strange, but and it worked. And I love that kind of stuff. I don't like when stuff sounds too songwriterish, when it's like, it sounds like a bunch of songwriters in the room. I just love when it's like conversational and it's different. It was like, wow, I wouldn't write that kind of lyric, but she did, you know. And I was intrigued by that. So long story short, I was like, we just need to work. We just need to work. I said to her, I'm gonna any prop maybe gonna do it. I was like, I'm not gonna do it. And I'm gonna dedicate everything to you. And she was like, I'm in. And that's what we did. We worked every day. And I mean, Sunday, Saturday, day, night. You know, she started sleeping at the studio. And it was full on. Because we needed to find a direction.
Right.
Right. So, you know, we did this whole rock and roll Zeppelin kind of Beatles thing at first for several months. And it just wasn't working. I played it for a couple people in the industry. They were just like, nah, man, this ain't gonna work. I'm like, why? They're like, well, first of all, it's like a chicken. Rock is rare. It's like, think about how many chicks really are getting rock regular. It's all male-driven. I'm like, yeah, I know. It's true. So
that's true.
You know, it was good, but it wasn't great. It wasn't like it's going to change rock radio and change, you know, rock females. It wasn't that. So
right.
I asked her if we could kind of do something more rock influence, but in the dance electronic kind of, you know, way, you know, a little bit more, you know, drum machine, a little more stiff, a little bit more Depeche Mode, a little bit more, you know, She Wants Revenge, you know. And,
right.
because she loved what we had done so much. You know, she like us stuff to it. I'm like Stephanie, you gotta try stuff. Like, you know, you can always go back to that. Like, you gotta just try. You know, just
right.
Do that. Just to do one track like this. Just to do one. So she agreed, and I'll never forget the day. It was that day where I sat at the drum machine, started programming a beat at an MPC, and she sat at the piano, and we just started vibing. And out of nowhere came this. She started playing this piano riff, and then I started developing the drum, and then I went to the bass and put the bass on it. And out came this whole other thing that I think neither of us knew was there, which was this very kind of like this funky rock dance electro thing that became her sound. That song was Dirty Rich.
Yeah.
That we did, and that set the direction for where she needed to go. Everything kind of came together in that one moment. We knew at that point what we needed to do. Once we did that, I took Dirty Rich and I brought it to five or six labels. Every single label was like, "Who the hell is this?"
Right.
And the next week we were having dinner at Nobu or one of the finest restaurants in New York with every president from each of the labels I bought, because they had wanted to sign her on the spot. Just
right.
Dirty Rich.
And that's incredible.
It's incredible. So she loved L.A. Reid because he wooed her. You know, he said she would change music with females, and he came in with his suit, and he has that, you know, that thing.
Yeah, of course. He totally does.
Right.
Yep.
And I get it. You know, I get it. I tried to talk to her about some of the other labels, but, you know, her mind was made up, and I respected that. And, you know, so she did the deal with L.A. And then, you know, a few months later, L.A. lost interest because he had, you know, whoever the next thing was, coming in, Bieber or whoever it was he was excited about. And he was just off Gaga. He loved it, and then he hated it. And then, we were fortunate enough to get a drop, though, because I'm like, well, wait a minute. He hates it. He has just sit on this for, like, 10 years and, like, not just
right.
Let her sit there. So we forced it out of his hand to get her off the label. So she came off the label, and of course, at that point, I couldn't go back to these labels that we had not taken the deal from.
Right.
They weren't going to do it, and I asked a couple of them. They were like, hell no. No way. She's damaged good. Those were the words. I'm like,
right.
Damaged good? Like, we didn't do nothing happened.
We didn't do anything, right?
Right. No record.
She
didn't bomb, or she didn't, like, you know, nothing happened. It's just,
yeah.
it was that perception that, something must have happened. L.A. dropped her that quick. She's no good.
It's going to be difficult or something.
Exactly.
Right? Something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah. And that wasn't the case. It was the opposite. So
right.
Anyway, I called everybody, Mark, and everyone was just like, nope. I had one last call because we hadn't gone to Interscope, and I went back to Vincent Herbert again because he had just done an indie deal with Interscope, and that was my last call. I'm like, Vince, man, you got to check this girl out. He said, yeah, send it to me. And that was the one that changed it all because he heard it. He heard Dirty Rich and a couple of tracks at Paparazzi and what we had done. And he was like, this is incredible. I'm going to get you in front of Jimmy. So needless to say, he put us in front of Jimmy. And Jimmy wasn't excited about it. He wasn't jumping out of his chair, but Jimmy, I mean, you know, he's like, well, I'll never forget he said this, and I'm like, this is not going to be good. He said, well, I guess if everybody in the room wants to do it, I'll do it. I'm like, what is that? That doesn't sound exciting at all. I'm like, but anyway, we didn't have anything else, so we had to do it.
Right.
So she wound up doing the deal over there, and, you know, months were going by. Like, I'm like, here we go again. And she's getting dropped off this label. And now she got dropped off the internet, so it's over. It's like, just
right.
go work up off, but go do something because we're not doing this. You know, so nothing was happening. I mean, they weren't doing anything. They weren't cutting the records. And from what I understand, I wasn't there. But, you know, Akon is the one who came to Jimmy at Dean's office at one point, and they were going over all the music. They were getting ready to the Queen House. And Jimmy had
right.
played Gaga's, like, you know, Paparazzi, one of the records with Akon. And Akon was like, what? He said, what? And that was it. That was,
wow.
Oh, at that point, I'll never forget, she had called me. You know, I was still speaking to her at that time. Gaga called me.
Right.
And she said the phrase, and I'll never forget this. I could hear this clear as day. She said, they're going to push the button. Is what she said, I'm like, what does that mean? I've never heard that before. And I've been
there right.
several years. She goes, they're going to push the button. I'm like, what button? And that's what Jimmy, those are the words Jimmy had said to her. Meaning that everyone, Jimmy had said in a meeting, and she was at the meeting apparently, she called after the meeting. Everyone from that point on, Jimmy said, stop working on whatever you're working on. Marketing, everybody, marketing, promotion, you stop what you're doing. Everybody shifts to Lady Gaga. Incredible.
That's incredible because you think about it. I mean, first of all, you know, L.A. Reid, God bless him, he made a boneheaded decision, number one. And then you had to go through, like, the securities process for, like, what? Like, the course of a year just to be put sort of in the back. And the only thing that saved you was, like, a random listening session with Akon. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. All that just, it comes down to that one moment. It's like, that's how fragile it is. And that's what I think, you know, writers and artists need to understand. That's why you have to keep that when you love it and you're determined. Because it just takes that one that you can't predict. You can never make that happen. It's just, it's going to happen when the stars align. You can't make it happen. You do your work. You keep going. And you do the best you can. And you fight for it.
Exactly.
But you don't know. You don't know when that little thing is going to happen. Because you're right. If, just imagine that day didn't happen. It wasn't going to happen.
Yes. It might have still, it might still be somewhere in some back room, you know, or it might have just been thrown away.
It absolutely would have been. She might be on an indie label, getting a little play here and there. Nothing would have happened. Like,
incredible.
Yeah. So that's it. That's the story. I know that was a long version, but I get carried away on it sometimes.
Okay. Now we know pretty much your whole story of how you came from, you know, really being a child prodigy, going from a classical music background to becoming, you know, through a series of events, one of the most sought-after songwriters and producers in the business.
It's like, it's no different than what we just said. A lot of those little things that happen are similar to that of Gaga, like these little things that just help the path, you know, help me find the path. Like, you know, little things, but, you know, somebody said to me once, you know, success is when opportunity meets preparation, you know, and it's so true when you think of it. It's an example of that. I was, you know, working my ass off and doing everything I could, but it wasn't until those little things, like the guy Vince Herbert coming over that one day and me having no ready. Now, I wasn't saying to myself, well, I got this idea for no, that I'll tell you when it's done. That wouldn't work. It would never happen, right? I'm like, when he came, I had it. It was done. It was ready enough that he could hear it. So it's like, it's a big part of it, right?
You've got to be prepared, and you've got to be prepared for anything that comes up. You know, like you said, when Beyonce walked into the room, it's like, all right, okay, I may be losing my mind inside, but right now I'm going to do my job. I'm going to do what I have to do, you know, in order to keep going, you know?
Exactly. And you do, and this is such a business of fake it till you make it. There's no other business more than this one. You fake it till you make it.
It's so true. Well, okay, so then we've gotten to this point where, you know, you've done a lot of amazing work as a songwriter, as a producer, and now you created this incredible body of work that was finally recognized after what seemed like the endless journey. So what happens next? What happens next? Tell us about that.
So, you know, without getting into the details,
right.
You know, I did what I wanted to do with Gaga, and we had started a company in the inception of everything, where we would share the profits, and, you know, we did several contracts and what have you. And look,
right.
I mean, without getting into why or who or when push came to shove, they didn't want to, you know, honor what was there. Okay, so whatever it is, that's what it is. And look, it's funny because I all the years, you know, up until that point, and we're talking about, you know, almost 15 years up until that point.
Yeah.
And then I had never been sued or had sued anyone and never been in any litigation, which if you think about it in the music business, it's unheard of because there's lawsuits every day and it's every year it seems like something else. But I was lucky enough, you know, and honest enough for that matter, just to not have any problems, legal or what have you, in the whole journey up at that point. But, you know, and I tried so hard to avoid anything legal in this you know, scenario as well. But it came to a point where I had thrown my hands up. I'm like, you know what? It's just nothing's working. Like, nobody wants to talk to me. I'm like, you know, and you know, she was doing really well, as you know. You know,
of course,
it was this bittersweet thing, because here's something that I helped build. They, you know, she's turned her back on me, and the whole team I brought to has turned their back for whatever reason. Whatever, if it's money or what have you, I to this day I don't know, but it is what it is.
Right.
So anyway, the point that I'm getting at is that runs its course.
Right.
In terms of, you know, the legalities, we work it out, we settle it, right? Okay.
Right.
But, you know, once again, something changed in me, and maybe this time something broke in me, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it. But, you know, one thing I've learned in my life is these are the broken moments sometimes are the moments that do change the course, and sometimes for the better.
Yeah.
And what right? And you don't see it in the moment. I was very distraught. I'm like, how could they do this? And I'm like, this music business sucks. And, you know, but something was born out of that frustration,
right,
out of that emotion. And what was born was me as a person. I think, you know, and not only in the singing capacity, but in the artistic capacity, because I was able to fulfill my artistic desire through other artists. And, you know, I
right.
give, you know, what, you know, I could say to a god, well, why don't you, you know, maybe when you play, you could move the hammer, and you could go over here to the stage, and you could use this chord. And I was living through them, and that was good, and that worked, you know, and it's fine. But I think after the Gaga project, something changed in me where I needed to hear the music really how I was hearing it, you know, in my
right.
head. And I felt that the only way I could get there was through me kind of writing, you know, the song, doing the production, singing the song. It wasn't really for something that I wanted to get a record deal, I wanted to be a star. It wasn't any of that. It was just I needed to do that because it was like breathing to me, and I felt that the calling was so strong just for me, not for anyone else. It was something that maybe I thought would be short-lived, but, you know, what happened was something changed, and I just felt like this phase of my, you know, songwriting and production was my diary. It was my therapy. And I needed, and it went on several years, you know, and I took the alias of Carrie Noki. And then, you know, people started booking me
right.
shows and tours. And then I got, you know, then RuPaul wanted me to do the drag queen tour. And then I did, you know, Macy Gray, and then after the ABC thing. But it wasn't a plan. The plan was really, let me just get back and kind of start over, if for lack of a better term. Because I think what happens with artists and songwriters is they're not willing sometimes to do that. And sometimes you have to humble yourself enough to say, I kind of need to go back to zero. And Carrie Noki was going back to zero for me. Because, you know, when I would go out and I would do stuff as Carrie Noki, a lot of people wouldn't even know Rob Bissard or what I had done. So it really was
right.
me starting over. And I said, you know what? I said to myself, at the very least, this is going to be an amazing journey, because I never really understood and appreciated what an artist goes through. The road, you know, being in front of people, making the mistakes, you know, all the things that I would try to teach them, I was kind of teaching them from afar in some way, because I had never done it. So I was telling an artist what to do for an audience, but I had never been in front of the audience.
Right.
So this was the time of my life where it was time for me to do it. And it was time for me to get the hard knock. And it was time for me to learn and live this life.
Right.
And look, it was not, and it is not an easy life. You know, I thought it was all fun and games, you know, the tour bus and everyone talking and partying. And then all of a sudden, I find myself in the midst of that world. And I'm like, what the hell? I can't even function like this.
Yeah, and it's a lot of hard work that you have to do through, like, with like a cloud of touring and people and hanging out and all of that.
Yep. And I found myself doing all the things that I tell artists not to do.
Right.
So I'm like, I found myself not writing anymore because, like, well, we're doing a local and then we got the Snapchat, and I'm like, and all of a sudden the days and the weeks would go by. I'm like, I haven't written, you know. And then I said, well, okay, so I'll write on the bus and
right.
And then I'm like, and then I tried to do that. I'm like, hell no, this is not working.
Right.
So it's like, you know, all the things that, it's almost like I went backwards and I did it in reverse, because now I understood, you know, what the artist development thing was in this capacity. Because I had done it. And look, I enjoyed it, and I still enjoy it. I love to perform, and I found a whole new, you know, way of writing and you know, doing music for myself, which I never thought I'd do. But like I said, through that angst, I was kind of reborn. And all of a sudden, I felt like an artist, whereas before I felt like this kind of, I was a songwriter. I'm like, you know, a regular kind of guy. And, you know, I just kind of wanted to blend in. But all of a sudden, through this thing with Gaga, like something snapped in a good way. And I was
right.
An artist was born. And now, today, even to this day, you know, I feel like a different person. It's even better because of it. And you know what? I've realized what success is. And like, I would never want that kind of success again. And I'm not saying that as a cop-out. I'm just saying it because it takes away from music and who I really am. The Gaga project got so big that it eclipsed everything else. You know, I think even people were like, it seemed like that was the only project I had done because it was so big. But that wasn't the case, as we know. So it kind of correlated to me, you know?
Right.
And, you know, it was like one thing that I always remember Jam and Lewis, you know, I spent time with them back in the day.
Yep.
You know who they are, right?
Of course.
They said to me one day, and I never forgot to go, you never want to get hot. You never want to be the hot producer, like the hot guy. Because like that just, all that does is tail off, and then you're done for the most part. But like you want to be lukewarm and just kind of just stay on this little kind of even keel for your whole career. I'm like, yeah, you know what I mean? And then I really felt that, because after Gaga, just everything got, I'm like, well, what do I do now? I didn't even know what to do now. It just, like, they got so big, you know. I couldn't go back and start developing a new art and put them into, like, hey, here's another art. I just wasn't,
right.
My mind wasn't there, you know. So anyway.
It's so funny that you got that advice from two guys who went exactly through what they told you not to do.
Exactly.
It's really interesting.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
They were like, you know, lesson learned here.
It's so true. It's so true. But, you know, it's like you almost can't help it in this business. Right. You don't have control over it.
Right.
You know? So, but anyway, you know, so that was like, you know, that was the post, you know, the Gaga thing. Because my first inkling was, you know, well, let me do this again. I can just keep doing Gagas.
Right.
And I was like, why would I can't do that. You know, so it's like, it kept changing. And then it kind of landed in this whole, you know, this whole different realm for me.
Right.
So, I gotta tell you, it's the first time in my career I think I found the one thing I didn't have the whole time, which is peace. And you work,
right.
You write, and you perform, and you do things differently when you're at peace.
And
you know,
that was sort of what I was going to ask about, just that, you know, you went from being wearing many different hats to finally wearing the hat of an artist as well as a songwriter and a producer. And that's something where, you know, it comes with challenges, but it also comes with more control and in some ways more freedom, right?
Yeah, it definitely does. It with all of it, on all sides, you know. And I think there's a big part of it that's gotten used to that. Like, when I write a lyric now, I don't have to wonder and ask the artist, you know, would you say that? Would you say something like that? You know what I mean?
It's
the freedom.
Exactly.
It's literally like we spoke about earlier, it's the conversation. I'm just having a conversation with myself, and I'm telling you, like, these songs are basically what's happened, you know, and I can just tell it in my own lyric. And it's a whole, that's why it's going to be, I'm not saying I'm not going to go back and do produce artists in the future. I may very well, but it's going to be a whole different, I have to shift mindset because, you know, it's such a tricky, tricky, you know, craft when an artist comes in and they say they write, and then you get in the room and they're like a mouse, like they don't write. The label just says they write. And you have to write the whole song. I mean, you kind of got to try to get inside their head and what are they thinking, and, you know, what happened to them the last couple. You got to draw on something that's real.
Yeah.
I can't put my story into their world. It's not going to work. It's got to be their story still. So it's a very tricky, you know, we, and we days on this. It's a very tricky relationship. And to find something that marriages and that really is believable with an artist who kind of writes.
Right.
You know, with a guy, it's easier. She knows what she wants to say, and you can merge that with what you do. It's a whole different thing. But then you got, you know, and this is a lot like seeking.
Right.
You know, which is obviously in the future we'll talk a lot about. But
right,
you know, trying to get inside the heads of some of these folks who are saying they want this, that, and the other, that hasn't been the move for me. It's almost like if they say one thing, I feel like they mean another.
Right.
And that's a very tricky, you know, it's a slippery slope. Because,
you have to read their mind almost. You know?
Right. And it's very dangerous because when they say, give me something like, you know, like Rihanna's, you know, whatever, it's like, no, they're not really saying that. They're not.
Right.
They don't really want that. They're saying that, but they don't really want that. You understand what I mean? Because if it's
too
much like it, you know, I mean, this is your world.
What they really want is they're like, you know what, I want something that's got the same sort of feel to it, but it's going to be unique. It's going to be something that
exactly.
I can use that'll give the effect that I want, but still it's going to be mine, you know?
Right.
There are a few things going on there, you know?
Right. It's almost like they want something that somebody, it feels like that record, that artist, but nobody would say it sounds or feels like that artist.
Right.
You know what I mean?
They don't want to come for a lot of reasons. People don't come right out and say, "Okay, I just want it to sound like Umbrella." Okay,
right.
Creatively,
right.
You know,
right. And that to me is a whole different. That's a whole different thing. That's like you. That's like carrier. That you're doing something else. But again, this is such a vast topic and creating and doing stuff. Because, you know, it's one of the questions that kind of hit me that, you know, you said to Jane, it's like, you know, it's like today, even like when I'm writing, it's like I'm always thinking on that side of things because that's the way a lot of records and artists are broken. So you have to think, will Apple play this? Well, can I see this on an Apple commercial?
Exactly.
Think, right?
Yeah, and the thing is that people, you know, when we're talking about sync or we're talking about composition, I mean, you know, whether it's licensing or scoring, I think that when you're taking a look at the way the music world works now, everybody wants to have a song in a hot TV show or in a commercial.
Absolutely.
Because that means audience.
Break.
And it means audience, and that means sales, and that means touring, and that means a recording contract and everything else that comes with it. You know, it's sync these days is really, you know, people focus a lot of the time on the money that they're going to make from the track, and let's face it, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm happy, you know, when people make money from the track itself, but really what you're looking at here is the kind of lift that you're going to get when you're a breaking artist and you've got a song with an Apple commercial.
Exactly.
Or like,
that's,
you know, there's, yeah, go ahead.
That's your radio. You got a better shot at than radio. Think about that. That's the radio. You're right.
Exactly.
And it's better than radio because you're linked to a product, and now it's an association. People associate
exactly.
You with something like Apple. So it's even better than radio. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is. It's like, you know, an example I can give you is, you know, one of my friends is Steve Smith from Dirty Vegas, and he and I have spoken about what happened to those guys in 2002 when some guy who was a creative at Saatchi & Saatchi heard the dance mix of Days Go By when he was at some nightclub in Amsterdam. And so, you know, it's a Vichy commercial. They win a Grammy, they have a number one hit, and a career is launched based on that one thing, alone all of the sales that happen. And that is not an isolated incident, you know? It doesn't need to be,
right.
You know, it doesn't need to be something that's, let's say, something that sells stuff in the millions, you know?
Not even, no. That's at the time
at
all, right? It could just break you, you have a career, it's like a whole different world.
Exactly. And that's what people, you know, that's what people really have to see. When you're talking about advertising specifically, right, it's more than radio because of two reasons to take them. One reason is because you're attached to the brand now, which is a good thing normally, as long as you're down with the brand, basically,
right.
As long as you're down with that brand. And secondly, now all of a sudden you're attached to their marketing budget. And if it's a car brand or if it's a computer brand,
huge,
hundreds of millions of dollars. So now you've got this enormous second vehicle behind you. And that, you know, that is something you just can't, you can't buy it. And the same, and you know, with television, okay, you know, if you get your song into a TV show, that's amazing as well, because it hits, you know, 100 million people a few times at least, you know, based on what show it is. And it's
a good association to get. Right? The scene might be something very emotional, so you're associated with a good scene. But, you know, you got that association thing again.
Exactly. And, you know, that's, I think that's really what a lot of people, you know, when they're looking at sync, what they should really be focusing on is, you know, when you're looking at your music, you know, you maybe shouldn't be saying to yourself, okay, I'm going to write this song for Hermès. You know, okay, that might be going a little too far unless you're commissioned by Hermès, right?
Exactly.
But you should visualize, you know, like, I could see this going into something.
That's the difference. That's exactly what I was going to say. You should be saying, can I see this in an Apple commercial? Yeah, I could see it now. As opposed to, let's create something for an Apple commercial.
Yeah, because that's usually the kiss of death, isn't it?
Never works.
Yeah. Because you don't know what they want.
In my experience, it works.
Yeah. You don't know what they want. You know, you're not in the creative's head at that time.
Exactly.
You know, you just have to say, okay, could this go in that direction? Well, let's find out.
Right.
So then talking about,
funny because even when you think you're in the creative's head, you could be saying the same words but hear different things and mean different things. That's what's so incredible about music and creativity. You could say the same exact things that you want. Yes, and it's got to be this. Oh, yes, got it. But you're still hearing different things.
Yeah.
Completely different things. Even though the words are saying the same thing that you want. Okay, we want it upbeat. We want it dirty, grimy. We want it urban. And then, but you're both thinking different things. You're saying the same thing you want.
Oh, yeah.
You can never match that. It never matches.
I mean, that's the thing about being a music producer in an ad firm or a music supervisor, is that in a lot of ways it's a really difficult job, because you know, you're trying to get into everybody's head, you know, and
right.
It's the same
right.
for a composer. You know,
yeah.
you're trying to
yeah.
get into the heads of like a brand, a creative, you know, a director, maybe you know, three or four other people.
It's a slippery slope, and then all of a sudden, like when you least expect it. I mean, I know this is because it was a hit. Now during the Super Bowl this year, National Geographic is taking Paparazzi.
Right.
I don't know. I think they're doing something with violins with it, and then it's $100,000 fee for like 30 seconds. So it's like, you know, then you get something like that. That's like, what the hell? They're taking
violins.
So you just can't explain this stuff.
Yeah.
It's just
you can't.
It's the strangest, you know, that's why trying to follow it, it's a very slippery slope. So you got to be careful how you navigate this world when you're creating this way.
I mean, I think it comes down to what you said. It's all about preparation. Just be prepared.
Yeah.
Now, okay, now getting from, you know, sort of the general and the process to you specifically in the work that you do, you know, how important has sync been for you and the artists that you've worked with? Take us through that a little bit.
You know, like I said to you earlier, it's become and becoming even to this day more and more important. Like when I first started, it wasn't really there. It wasn't even a thought. But, you know, as I saw, you know, things changing, and look, you could trace it back to something as early as, you know, for me, one of the things I noticed was when television, I think it was the Michael J. Fox sitcom that he had, Billy Vera and the Beaters, I think it was, this At This Moment song. And, you know, it literally changed things forever for that song and for that group because of that sync and that power that existed between the scene of him and his girlfriend on the show, and that song coming on. It was like everybody was talking about it. Everybody was pulling out for that record. People were still buying records at that time. So,
right.
you know, I think that it's become more and more, you know, prominent for me because, like I said to you earlier, I could see going, you know, even further in that direction in terms of, you know, forget radio, because I see too much now of artists that can break without radio, with proper sync. You know, so it's almost like, you know, and one of the things that, you know, I really, you know, what changed for me, you know, working with Doug is how sometimes lyrics can play so many different ways, and it can work for so many different, you know, advertisers and products that, you know, it what's really cool sometimes is it's never that direct, right on the money thing. It's like, yeah, now that you said, I could see it with Q-tip, or, you know, it's like with a Q-tip word, it's like all of a sudden it shifts the meaning of the lyric, you know what I mean? But, you know, they use Beautiful Dirty Rich for one of the, you know, the Dirty Maids.
Right.
You know, that's a little more obvious, you know, in terms of what it's used for. But
right.
I think it's really cool when something gets used and it's like, wow, I didn't even think of that. And that's like kind of what you're saying, that preparation is having, you know, a plethora of work, that just, a body of work that really can just go in so many different directions. And, you know, and look, you got to be creative because, you know, when somebody asks for something, the wheels have to turn in such a way that you're thinking of things that are outside of the straight-ahead obvious. Because a lot of the times it's never that obvious thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like that kind of like backdoor, kind of like quirky song, or that quirky, you know, hook that can get them. So, I mean, like, again, back to your question, I mean, you know, I think about it all the time, you know, when I'm
right.
recording, when I'm, you know, doing production, when I'm writing lyrics. I don't think about it like you said, like, oh, I want to try to gear this for a specific sync or show or product. But I'm thinking,
right.
wow, I can really hear this. And I'm going through my mind, who would mess with this? Like, who could, like... If I got a call tomorrow from a company that's working, you know, for IBM or what have you, you know, what tunes would I have? What, so it's like the catalog, your catalog
yep.
as you're going.
Yep. Yep.
You know what I mean? So it's like I'm
always
thinking about it. But yeah, I mean, obviously there's been other things that there's been specific that can you try something for, you know, this or that, and I'll do something specific for it, but. You know, it, like I said earlier, it's something that I'm still going to do the work in such a way that it feels like the work is being, you know, come from a place of heart and soul, that it's not like, wow, this is cheeky and it's not like, you know, so obvious.
Right.
You know,
that's the
lot
thing.
Like,
yeah, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
It's a lot like, I'll never forget reading about how John Lennon wrote Come Together. He was asked to do a song for this politician, you know, for
right.
the campaign. And he did Come Together, but it, you know what? Come Together, it feels nothing like that, like a politician song, but it's so great that it lives even outside of, it was never used for the politician, but that's how it's
right
to be. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you some of the reasons that you don't want to, you know, write a song specifically to program somebody is because it might be like, music, the music that the brand wants of you, that the supervisor wants, may be, like you said, it may be a little bit different than what you think. You know, the lyrics may be, or the melody may be something that might not work with the brand at first glance.
Right.
But the
right.
creative has a completely different idea. So if you're sort of banging it over the head by saying, you know, I'm going to somehow put in something about, you know, 4G access or something, and hope that there's a tech brand that's
yeah,
going
right,
to
right.
into the fact that I did that in the bridge, it's not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. You know? Yeah.
They're not, you know, you and I both know, they're not looking for that. They're not.
No.
They're trying to be cool and ahead of innovators. They're trying to be, like, you know, ahead of the game. Like, you know, like,
exactly.
Look what they found and look what they, you know, developed. And because of our commercial, you know, they want to be cool, like hip, you know, so it's like, that's not the way to be hip with it. You know, it's funny because it made me think of a story that, you know, a couple years back when they were doing the James Bond movies, I was asked to submit something. And I did
right.
a song called Bang Bang, and it actually came down to the song I had did, that and the Jack White song with Alicia Keys, and they went with the Alicia Keys song. So it was between the two. But what happened was, in the midst of that, somebody heard Bang Bang and wanted it for they used it for Grey's Anatomy, and so that's something I could have
wow.
planned for, but because I was going I was shooting for the stars. You know, I was going all the James Bond movie, you know what I mean? And I didn't get it. But, you know, I fell short, but short wasn't so bad. You know, the Grey's Anatomy thing, which is like, you know, a very, very well-paid thing.
Yeah, that's really not bad. And, I mean, that really comes from having the attitude that no matter what you're making, it's all about the music, first and foremost.
Right.
You know, you might be thinking about a brand, you might be thinking about a TV show or something, but when it comes down to it, the music has to be sound, because then it can go into any direction.
Exactly. And even though Bang Bang was kind of specifically for that, it was, but it wasn't. You know what I mean? Because it fell in a different direction. It could fall somewhere else. Because it was music at it, like you said. It was still what I do, and I can stand behind it and say, this shit's hot. Like, this is good.
Yeah. And that's, I think, a key takeaway for people that are listening to this who are creators. Is that,
absolutely,
you know, you've got to be able to walk away from it and say, this hits hot. You really do.
Exactly.
Have to be able to say, you know what, I've done my job as a producer, as an artist, as a composer, whatever hat that I'm wearing. And,
right.
You know,
no, yes.
You've got to be able
to play it for somebody without saying, oh, this is something we did for the Apple commercial.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is something I'm going to submit for. You've got to be able to play it without saying any of that. Because that says that if you have to say, oh, I'm going to try to get this thing out, then you're off base already.
Yeah, exactly.
Just, I got to check this song out. This is something I'm working on, and it just lives on its own, like you said, lives on its own.
Yeah, that's the only way, and I think that's the only. That's like you said, you know, a music supervisor, a creative, both of them. You know, one of the key things they have in mind. I mean, the first thing they have in mind is emotion. I think that a sync. A song needs to emote something that they want to get across to a consumer or to an audience. And that's, I think, the first and foremost thing that they're looking for. And then the second thing is, you know, how good is the creative in general? You know, it's emotive and it's really, really a tight song. And then from there, they get into all the business stuff in the background. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
But those are the two things. You know, and you never know what emotion that they're going to look for. So, again, it goes back to what you said. Just be prepared. Be prepared.
Exactly. It's right on the money. You're right on the money.
So, you know, what are some of the things that you've had from your works or work that you've collaborated on that you thought were really cool? Or give us one example.
I got to tell you, the one example I'm going to give you is the one that didn't generate a lot of money, but it was something that just was really organic, and it was an MTV show. I'm trying to remember which show it was, but
right,
it was for an MTV show, and you know it was actually with the artist was that girl I was telling you about, who was my first, you know, god, if you will, the girl Lisa.
Right.
And I just remember, you know, because it was something that I was creating from the start, and there wasn't a label involved. It was something me and Jane actually, you know, went after in terms of reaching out to them and, you know, hey, you got any shows, whatever, any music, blah, blah, blah. And we did the legwork, and it came back with a really cool thing and a great, you know, and they used a whole bunch of the song, and I still get, it's funny because I still get paid for it to this day, you know? A lot of the things that I've gotten are just, you know, obviously when the song becomes a hit, like I just saw a couple weeks ago that they used Bootylicious on the Candy Crush game commercial. I'm like, because they're saying, I don't think you're ready for this jelly, you know?
Right.
And I guess the game has jellies in it or something.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
that must have been a nice thing. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that, you know, that just because the song was a hit, they would have never known about that song. I would have never submitted something like that, thinking that jelly and it's so odd to me sometimes the stuff they think. You can't even, you know what I mean? But the ones that are like the organic kind of, have this organic thing to them, like that MTV one. And then when I saw it in the scene, I remember thinking to myself, oh yes, they get it, like you got it. You know what I mean by that? Like when you see that come together,
Totally.
And you're like, the scene matches, it feels like the way I saw it in my head. It was kind of, it had like this rock and roll Pretenders thing to it. And the scene felt like, it, and I think that's why it lives on. And it's funny because, like we were talking about, to this day, they still must play the, you know, it keeps syndicating. And somewhere in some country, they're still playing. And it just, it lives because it's good. And when something is, like you said, it's good to live. And it's going to generate income for, you know, probably the rest of your career or your life, you know?
Right.
So it's full circle in what we were saying. It's a solid song. It's not something that I created for MTV, but it's something that I thought would be great, you know, synced up to the right feel of and a young MTV feeling. And it was like,
right.
Look, I gave him five or six things. And he didn't use all of them, but he found his love in that one. And I remember him calling us, like, this shit's fucking amazing. He's like, I want to use all of them. He didn't use all of them. He didn't like, say he wanted to. But even that one was like, felt like, wow. That's the first time I remember saying, wow, this whole state thing can work. You know? And it was like, there's something here. And that's when, you know, I mean, we started talking at Chop Shop and, you know, because I wanted to get more involved, and I started exploring this world more. You know,
sure.
So like that. So that was kind of that was big for me because it kind of changed the way I saw, you know, the whole sync thing. I started exploring, you know, that world more, and it started changing the way I think and the way I, you know, think about going about, you know, maybe grammar sync or like how to, you know, how to maneuver in that world. Cause it is different. Even though it's a similar thing, there's some different way of thinking about things. You catalog differently than if you're thinking about songs, you know, for an artist. You know, it's just a different mindset of how you think and how you catalog in your brain.
Right, exactly. I mean, you have to look at it in terms of, like, you know, if you're looking at one supervisor or another, I mean, like, look, you're talking about Chop Shop. I think about what Alex deals with from one show to another. On one show, she might need something from South Korea. On another show, she might need something from Brazil. And on another show, she might need, like, just straight-on R&B. You know, so
right.
it doesn't really track the way that you would say, you know, okay, this artist is going to go in this direction mainly. Because she's dealing with multiple projects and multiple people. So, you know, you've got to look at it as somebody that's bringing the music in the context of how that person's job is done and how that's helped them to do their job, which is a very different, I mean, it's similar in some ways, but in other ways, it's very different from what you're doing with a songwriter or with
very much.
A co-writer.
Yeah. Very much. And it's funny because early on when I was, you know, speaking with them, I didn't understand it yet completely. And I get it more now, but they came back, I'll never forget, and it threw me off. And I wasn't expecting it. And I guess I wasn't, my thinking wasn't there yet. But one of the acts that I sent them, the song, they were interested in signing the act. And they wanted to go back. And I was like, wait a minute, where did that come from? And I wasn't up to speed yet at that time that this is how things could work. Because I guess they realized, you know, we could break this act with the thing. We're the label because we can break them. That's it. It's that simple.
Right.
If you want to really, you know, don't even talk about the marketing, the promotion, the radio. And I didn't get that yet at that time. So I was like, oh, no, that's not, no. So, you know, I wasn't ready yet. But now, like today, thinking about, like, wow, that I get it now.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a central part of the process now for anybody is to say, okay, as part of breaking an act, an artist and the people around them alike have to think this way. You know, it's not just, okay, you got to go for a bunch of gigs. You know, you got to do that still. You got to do some stuff with social media. You got to figure that out. You know, you got to figure out your publishing. You've got to figure out a label. But you really have to figure out in terms of your marketing, you know, social media and licensing. You know, social media
it's true.
Huge thing that 10 years ago, if you said that to people, they'd go, yeah, it seems interesting. But that's about it. You know, it wouldn't be an afterthought.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be central. Now it's central.
Exactly. And look, I tell artists all the time, like, you know what, forget the record deal. You know, I'm out there, I'm in the field, they're not signing that. Like, go get a sync. I'm like, work your ass off getting a sync. Forget the record deal. And that's the mentality. You have to have that mentality.
You get the right thing, they'll come to you. You'll get every record deal in the world come to you. Go get this thing. That's what you work towards. Forget the record deal.
Yeah. You know, you get a song in, one of the commercials that's going to be on Sunday, and I guarantee you, if you're not known, number one, you're going to be known, and number two, on Monday, you're going to have every single major coming at you
exactly.
Monday morning.
It's funny, it's funny because one of the co-writers that I work with a lot, and I still work with her, is Makiba. And, Makiba,
right.
is all she's doing now is writing for television, like the show Star.
Yeah.
And it's changed. So even the songwriters are not out there trying to get cuts anymore. They're out. She's writing for the show. You know
right.
what I mean? So it's like everything's changed. So it's like you got to change with this and you got to go. That's really where the action is right now. It's right there.
And
the labels know it. The labels know it, too. And they're chasing it, too. They don't know really how to do it sometimes, but, they're chasing it.
Oh, they're definitely chasing it, that's for sure. You know, and in some ways, like you said, some are better than others. Let's put it that way. Some are better than others in doing it. I'm going to be political and say some do a good job. Other ones, they're not really up to speed,
Very true.
But when it comes down to it, when you look at it from where you sit right now, How much of what you do in your creative process do you do that's, on a day-to-day basis that's geared towards this portion of the business?
Like I said, I think it's all there. I don't think you can separate it anymore. I can't separate the two worlds. If they're married now, they're two. There's no line that you can really separate and say, okay, this is going to be music driven and just for radio and my
right.
tour. You can't. It's all meshed together.
Right.
There's no way. It's almost like once you put that, the oil and vinegar together or it just, you can't separate those two things. It's like they're just they're there. Even if the oil and the vinegar separate in the glass, you still can't separate them. You know what I mean by that? So you can see two separate things when you look in the glass. But go ahead and try to take the vinegar out without the oil, some oil. So they're in the same world. You can't, even though they're two different things, they're not anymore, So it's impossible for me to say that, I'll spend some time on it. No, everything, even sonically, I'm thinking to myself, and I'll do this. I'll actually run my laptop through the TV to hear on the TV speakers. Like, what would this sound like on the TV? Will this translate? So I'm even thinking sonically, will this translate to the TV speakers?
That is so smart. I think everybody who's listening to this now has to put their music through TV.
That's such a great idea.
It
sounds completely different. I'm telling you that right now. I'll change things sometimes because I'm like, on the television, I don't hear the kick drum. I don't hear the vocal in the voice. The vocal
right.
So it changes the perspective.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, so let me ask you a question just to close things out. What are you doing right now? I mean, I think one of your most recent projects, we talked about this offline a little bit, but, it's near and dear to my heart, is working with Martin Fry on Lexicon of Love 2. So you're still keeping your hand in, working with other artists on a regular basis, right? It's not just, okay, all I'm doing is solo work at this point.
No, I am keeping open to that, and Martin and the group, they want me to go back out in April to the UK and do some more shows and some more writing. I think he's going to gear up for the next record, so I'm going to do that. I'm also, I was asked to do, which I started already, I'm a musical director for university, for William Patterson University, is doing a show which is very dear to my heart, and it's an 80s night, an 80s tribute night, and they asked me to come in and the musical director of the show. And when I heard that, because the 80s music is so dear to my heart, and it's like a no-brainer, I took on that.
Right.
I told them I would do it, so I've been working on that. And Mark Goodman from MTV is going to be hosting the show. It's going to be big.
Oh, that's cool.
Big event with featuring all these 80s, running against what's his name from Run DMC is performing. I can't remember his name right now. But,
What date is this?
It's the, I'm going to have, I think it's the 24th of March, I think. 24th. You should come out.
I'm gonna definitely come out. I'll put it up on our website and make sure the people get to know.
Yeah, definitely. It's gonna be an awesome 80s tribute night. So you know, me kind of going back. What's really great for me is me going back and listening and you know, relearning, if you will, these tunes, because you know, I got into all the parts and like, you know, like, wow, I didn't realize the bass was doing that in Duran Duran song, like, or you know, or what have you.
Yeah.
So it's really been like nice for me to go back and listen to these songs, how amazing the craft, how they were crafted. Like we were talking about earlier about ABC. A lot of this stuff, like people don't, like the new cats don't realize, like you got to go back. This is where a lot of this stuff came from. You got to study this stuff. It's all there, man. It's like you go to school and lose yourself for a good year studying the 80s, the whole, you know, period.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, so much. I always say to people, though, you know, it makes me sound like I'm a bit of a, you know, stick in the mud, though I'm not at all musically. But sometimes I say to people, like, the 80s was probably the last great creative period in modern music. Because
it was.
Freedom that was given to artists to do whatever the hell they wanted.
It was. There's no stick in the mud on that one. I'll stand right behind it. I'll sing that from the mountaintop. It was, I'm telling you. Look, the 90s did give us some nice, you know, grunge stuff, but the 80s was the last of, you're right, the pop creative freedom. That all the diversity in the music, we don't get that anymore. You kidding me?
No.
Not even close.
I mean, I think about some of the guys that I know. I mean, it's like, I think about, you know, Martin and ABC is one of them. Another one is, you know, like, you know, the guys from the Human League and Heaven 17.
Oh, my
God. The direction that they went into. You know, I mean, like, what Martin Ware did was, like, just, to, you know, turned out of nothing.
Out of control.
Yeah. And
unbelievable.
You see that for group after group after group. You know, it's not just synth pop.
Yeah, unbelievable. Yeah. This is genius pop music. Genius pop music.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The stuff that these guys came up with. And they were allowed to. Like, it was last time, like, I think this is why, this is the point that I was getting to. The last time that the label was allowed to go out there and just make music and not care about
the business. Right. They know what to step aside and let the artist be the artist. You're right. They don't do that anymore. They don't.
Right. Exactly.
So, not my
thing. I haven't seen it. The music suffers, but the artists suffer because they're constrained.
You know, it's funny you said, not only does the artist suffer, but I've met a bunch of artists, incredible artists, that, you know, they said, I'm not doing this. I'm not going to go lay it above that. So they wind up not even doing it. So we suffer because it's like we don't get the music. Because it's like a lot of people are like, nope, not doing it. Because they know the game now. They know I'm not going to go. I'm not going to have to change it. And then they're going to do this. Like, so they don't even go for it. I'm like, you got to go for it. Like, you're incredible. Like, nope, don't want it.
And see, that's why sync is so important to close this out, right? Is that sync, you don't need to have necessarily, you know, a constraint of a label in order to get sync. In fact, it's almost the other way. You know, you just go out there and you make really good music. And, you know, you get the word out about it. You know, good things may very well happen.
You're right. It kind of harkens back into how it used to be. You're right. Through the same. Yep.
Exactly. And let's see. So just to close things out, I'll definitely be by in March, first of all. But thank you so much for taking the time with me.
Oh, man. Good talking. That was fun, man. That was awesome.